Wills versus Wills. Timothy R. Bradley, Caroline E. Costell, Carrie S. Greenberg, Appellant's Counsel, James Ray Cottrell, John K. Cottrell, Appellee's Counsel.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good morning. May I please
remove my mask?
Yes, please.
And good morning to the justices of the court. My name is Timothy R. Bradley, and I represent the appellant, Lisa N. Wills, along with my colleague, Ms. Carolyn Costell, who will be handling the rebuttal in this case. Mr. Chief Justice, I would ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
For Ms. Costell. To the court, the inescapable facts of this case are these. The parties were married in December of 2004, and on January 8, 2005, they entered into a property settlement agreement. The trial court found that on that date, they entered into a property settlement agreement, and the trial court further found that by April of that same year, just a few months later, the marriage had entered into a period of irreconcilable differences and that the parties intended to divorce. Following that separation, the trial court further found that the parties reconciled, they went on romantic vacations, they had a child together, and they were living together fully as husband and wife. The trial court further found that throughout the course of the marriage over the next 10 years, there were other instances where the parties had separated and that they reconciled again. These facts were also admitted to by Dr. Wills in his pleadings. Now, at trial, the trial court applied Code Section 20-155, which is plain on its face. The code section provides that a reconciliation of the parties after the signing of a separation or a property settlement agreement shall abrogate such agreement unless otherwise expressly set forth in the agreement. Now, to the court, I would say that the crux of the issue in this case is, was this contract a property settlement agreement? Because the facts are entirely undisputed that the parties afterwards did have reconciliations and separations on multiple occasions. So our argument is that
the Court of Appeals Counsel interpreted that language to say the reconciliation is the timing point. So if you make a property settlement agreement during a pre-reconciliation in the process of being unreconciled, then that's the term of art being used. But if you make basically a prenuptial agreement the day after marriage where there is no unreconciled state, it's a completely different animal. What fault do you have for that reasoning?
Well, there are a few reasons, Your Honor. The first being that the statute does not have any language at all about what kind of separation there might need to be that would be concurrent with the signing of an agreement. The statute doesn't say anything about when a separation would or would not occur. And frankly,
doesn't it presuppose that the agreement is made during an unreconciled state? Why would they write it that way? If you have reconciliation and you don't expressly address that in your agreement, then it's off the table. Well, doesn't that presuppose you made the agreement during a state of unreconciled relations?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that the operative language in this code section is the reconciliation. It is the reconciliation that abrogates the agreement. And our argument for why this makes sense is that in the context of a marriage, what is or is not an irreconcilable separation, I don't know what word the General Assembly would actually use to say that the parties are separated, it's not easily definable. In every case, the separations are different. I mean, we have cases where people are separated for a week. We have cases where people think they're separated, but they're still sharing the same bedroom and going on dates with each other, but they're telling people they're getting divorced. We have cases where one party is telling friends that they're getting divorced, and the other one thinks that they're still happily married. And so what actually is a separation is not defined by the statute. The word isn't even really used in the statute at all. So the word that the General Assembly chose to use was a reconciliation. So what we do have in Virginia is that there is case law defining what is a reconciliation. So a reconciliation is the complete resumption of the marital relationship. So
can I give you a hypothetical? Suppose you have a prenup and it's signed the day after the wedding, after the license, the marriage license. So it's signed a day into the marital estate, and they're married for 30 years. And there is a separation, and there is a reconciliation. is that document off the table forever if it does not expressly have the caveat necessary?
I just want to make sure I have the hypothetical clear. You're talking about an actual
document
that was signed before the marriage.
No, a typical prenuptial agreement. You know, here's how we're going to live our entire marriage, and if things go south, here's how we're going to divide it up. A typical prenup. But it's actually not entered into the day before the marriage. It's entered into the day after the marriage.
Well,
and it doesn't say anything about reconciliation, abrogating anything. Would your logic apply to that document after a 30-year marriage?
Assuming that there were subsequent separations and reconciliations.
Yeah. And then a reconciliation.
I would say so, Your Honor, because the problem with the hypothetical is that a typical prenup, by definition, is signed before the marriage.
I know. I'm supposing that it should have the same effect the day after the marriage when it's entered into in a state of non-separation and no need for reconciliation. That's the problem I'm trying to figure out.
Well, first of all, those are not the facts of our case. But what I would say, Your Honor, is that a prenuptial agreement is extremely different than any sort of agreement that you sign with a spouse after you're married. Because before you are married, you have no obligations to this other person. It might be a person you're dating.
I'm in total agreement with that. Don't worry your time with that. Of course. I'm talking about intending to do the same object as a prenup, but you do it the day after the marriage. When there is no separation on the table, there's no need for reconciliation discussion, there's no need for anything.
And in that case, I think it's entirely dependent on what the actual provisions of the agreement say. I think you could have something that's similar to that type of document that's not actually a property settlement agreement. You could have an agreement that two spouses get married and they're perfectly happy, they're not separated, and they just agree, you know, we're going to create a family trust, and this is how it's going to be. If we have kids, the kids will get this amount of trust. If we die, we want the property to go to the children instead of to each other. That I would not consider to be a property settlement agreement at all.
Property settlement would be, if we get divorced, you get this, I get that.
Correct. And I think this is what the trial court, you know, going back and reading through the trial court's ruling in the transcripts, I think the trial court was very specific with this, that part of its ruling, and I think this is correct, is that the word settlement means something here in the statute, is that you're actually settling a dispute, whether it be a potential future dispute or a current dispute. A property settlement agreement is a document that is settling a dispute, whether it's potential, future, current, or past. And so what we have here in the Wills case is a document that specifically addresses how they want to settle a future dispute. It talks about how property is going to be divided in the event of a divorce. And we know that the General Assembly intended that parties could enter into that sort of contingent agreement because Code Section 20-150 says married parties may enter into agreements contingent upon separation, divorce, death, or any other event.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? This 20-155 is the last statute in the section premarital agreement. Why do you believe that that third sentence is in 20-155 in the location that it is? It seems to be inconsistent with the first two sentences of 155.
Well,
because the first sentence says that a postnuptial agreement can be treated the same way as a prenuptial agreement if you follow the language of the statute. Second sentence seems to talk about oral agreements. The third sentence seems to be something different because it talks about separation and property settlement agreements.
Well, let me walk through the history of this a little bit, Your Honor. To begin with, these middle clauses about agreements entered into as part of a court order or through a deposition, that was not there when the last sentence was added to the statute. So that was added subsequently. Why the General Assembly chose to put this sentence at the end of the statute, I don't know. But what I know is that prior to the sentence being put in the case of Yeach versus Yeach, a published Virginia Court of Appeals case, Yeach decided that there was common law in Virginia that the courts will presume an intent when parties reestablish a marital relationship after separation that any prior agreements would cease to exist. The idea being that you're separated, you think you're going to get divorced. At that point, you know, whatever agreement you have would be the agreement that's going to govern the divorce, and that after deciding to get divorced, you reconcile. So the theory is that when you reconcile, anything prior to that is water under the bridge. You're almost renewing your marital vows, you're starting the marriage fresh, And at that point, you're going to be governed back to whatever the standard Virginia law is between married people.
But that, can I interrupt for a second and then go back to your answer? That's a problem, I think, because the rebutting statute that's changing the case law is a case law presumption that if you're in a state of separation, if you're in a state of needing reconciliation, if you're ever going to get it, and you make an agreement and you get back together, it's done. But we're talking about an agreement that was not made in a state of separation or in a state of negotiating an actual separation. We're talking about an agreement that was written for the possibility of that happening.
Your Honor, I'll address that very briefly, and then I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. I think one of the assignments of error we actually have in this case is that the Court of Appeals took it upon itself to decide that these parties were not in a state of separation. At the trial court level, there was actually evidence that the parties were separated, that they were in separate bedrooms, they weren't sharing meals, Dr. Wills wouldn't allow Ms. Wills to even do his laundry, and that he was threatening divorce. Now, because of the trial court's analysis, it actually never made a ruling on that issue because the trial court decided it doesn't matter what their state of their marriage was then, because I specifically find that after they signed this, they separated and reconciled on multiple occasions.
So
the Court of Appeals jumped in and made a factual.
Your worst case scenario here would only be a remand for determining if they were in a state of separation at the time.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I see. Thank you.
I would like to reserve the rest of my time for
Ms.
Castle.
All right. You have 3 minutes and 53 seconds.
Thank you.
Can I remove my mask, Mr. Chief Justice?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is John Cottrell. I'm accompanied by James Cottrell, and we are representing Mr. Neil Wills today on appeal. We would respectfully ask that this court affirm the ruling of the Court of Appeals where they defined separation or property settlement agreement for the last sentence of 2155 as marital agreements made in connection with the dissolution of a marriage or separation. And among the many reasons why we believe this is the correct definition, it harmonizes the statute as a whole.
If your thesis is right, wouldn't the appellant's last point be implicated, which is, well, we've never had that fact-finding issue, and who knows what the state of, as he says, it's always very messy to figure that out.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that evidence was presented below, and Judge Fiore made specific findings, and he did not find that the parties were in a state of separation at the time that this agreement was signed.
He did not make those findings, right?
He did not make that finding.
So
he found
again,
specifically.
Is my logic messed up here? If you were to win on your basic theory, which is, no, none of this kicks in until the agreement we're talking about was made during a separation period where the issue on the table is, are we going to stay together or not, versus before that time frame. Because if it was made during that time frame, even under your thesis, he would win.
I believe that we also have to look at the content of the agreement and the intent of the agreement, which is not just whether they were in a state of separation, but what was the intention of the agreement. I believe they're really stretching the facts here to try to say they were separated legally during that time. But if you look at what was going on under the facts, Dr. Wills was saying...
So that I'm clear,
yes,
before you get into the
yes.
facts, did you say that the trial court did or did not make a factual finding as to whether they were or were not separated?
To be fair, Your Honor, it's silent about that, but he's made very specific findings, and that's something he didn't find. When he's giving his reasoning, he says afterwards the parties separated, and he points to a separation in April of 2005 as the first separation. And so my assumption from that is that his inference is that he did not find that they were separated when they entered into this agreement. But I would argue it's not decisive under the facts that were presented because Dr. Wills is saying, I want this agreement to remain married. I need this for my protection because, as the evidence showed, they had already been discussing a premarital agreement leading up to the marriage. And they didn't get that done in time, so it's effectively like the hypothetical that Justice Kelsey was presenting, where it was a month after the marriage, but similar situation. And if you read the agreement, again, the four corners of the agreement, it is not written as a separation of property settlement agreement with the intent to terminate the marriage. It doesn't say that they are separated. It has conditions and performance required by Dr. Wills while they are together and not separated.
So under your logic, assume without conceding anything that, yes, in fact, on the date of the agreement, they were clearly separated.
Yep.
But the document doesn't restate the obvious, that they're living in different homes and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It just says, look, here's what we're doing going forward. This goes here, that goes there. Under your analysis, is that covered by 155 or not covered by 155?
I believe that would be covered by the first sentence of 2155 when you have an agreement like this. Because it's effectively, if they were separated at that point and they're entering into this, and remember her duress claim was, you're trying to make me sign this to stay married, then it's a reconciliation agreement. It's an agreement, okay, we're going to resume this on these terms. And it's not, we're separated now, so you get the house and I pay you alimony for this period of time. It's presumed that we're staying together, but if we happen to separate in the future, this happens. If I die, this happens. It's a different intent shown by the wording of the agreement, which takes it out of, it's not the exception in the last sentence of the statute. It's the first sentence of the statute, which is the public policy that married persons can enter into these agreements under the same conditions, same effect, same extent.
But the last sentence says it has to be expressed in the contract that reconciliation doesn't abrogate, right?
If it's a separation of property settlement agreement, and of course that's the debate here, is that this is not by definition a separation of property settlement agreement because it is not written from the perspective of dissolving the marriage. It is continuing the marriage. And that was the evidence said that was the intent, and the agreement shows that, most importantly.
My last question, I apologize, but I'm still confused.
Okay.
If, without conceding anything, this document was written in a time where everyone conceded the parties were legally separated, mm-hmm, there was no intent to go forward except for whatever contingencies may be, and the document doesn't say anything about expressly keeping its revival in the event of later reconciliation. Under 155, what's the right legal answer to that hypothetical, which I know you're suggesting is not your case?
The reason why I hesitate to say that it would be under the last sentence in that hypothetical is that you could have an agreement where the purpose is to reconcile. And that's what, I know you don't want me to argue the facts, but that seems to be what this factual scenario presented. And so we do have to have room, not just for a marital agreement that's entered into when people are happy, and of course there are separation and property settlement agreements, we have to have room for the idea of a reconciliation agreement. And so, and there, you're not coming under the last sentence because this is the agreement on which we're reconciling, as opposed to here's the agreement on which we're separating, but even if we reconcile, which right now we're not intending to, it will remain in effect. So that's why I hesitate to go all the way on that one. And then I would submit that we have enough of a factual record to dispute the idea that they were separated, both from the absence of a finding to that effect by Judge Fiore. And remember, they weren't claiming that they were living in separate houses or something like that during this, I think it was a week leading up to the signing. So I believe that the evidence supports us on that. I would also point out just other reasons why the Court of Appeals was correct, that this court already made a comment about this in the Flannery versus Milton case, where Justice Lacy makes a statement that the 1998 amendment anticipates agreements made during proceedings for dissolution of a marriage by providing that a signed property settlement agreement is abrogated if the parties reconcile. So I realized that Flannery was dealing with a different issue, an oral agreement made on the record of a deposition. But this is a statement made, there's no dissent, and when the General Assembly directly amended the statute the next year, based on what happened in Flannery, to allow oral agreements on the record, they didn't change anything about the last sentence. And so I would submit that is support for the fact that this is how family lawyers understand the use of the term property settlement agreement, and that it is not. Because otherwise, again, the exception would swallow the rule. Because the overall rule, when in 1986, when they passed the Premarital Agreement Act, and it's only that first sentence, is to let married people enter into these agreements the same way that engaged people can enter into these agreements. So I, going further from that, I would point out that the two cases that gave rise to this rule of law, Yike and Smith, the agreement is called a property settlement agreement. And the policy is all about separation agreements, though. They're using it like a synonym, and they're acknowledging, well, they're just reciting the fact that those agreements were called property settlement agreements. And so abrogating an agreement premised on separation or divorce, as the Court of Appeals defines it, that makes sense. You can see how that's like a basic contract concept. Once the premise of the contract is gone, why would you perform? But if the agreement is premised on the continuation of the marriage, then it doesn't make any logical sense to abrogate such an agreement and just have a do-over for no particular reason.
What if the document is signed when they are technically not separated, but they're planning to separate 2 months later? Kids are coming home from college. We're going to separate then. We're not separated now, but we're going to separate. We'll agree. We'll separate in 2 months. And they're not in a state of separation at the time of the agreement. Is that within or outside of 155?
I think there, with those facts came out, and maybe it would even be written where it would express that, then that would come under the last sentence because that is the intent of the agreement. I don't believe there's a problem. I know that one of their arguments is, well, we shouldn't have to have a lot of evidence in this kind of circumstance. But in any dispute over formation of a contract, some evidence is presented. And so in that circumstance, the proponent of the agreement could say, or I guess the person disputing the agreement would say, well, this was the circumstance in our discussions when we entered into this agreement. Likely, the agreement would say, like in the Yike case, that the parties are separated with the intent to remain separate permanently. That would probably be an agreement that is a separation of property settlement agreement, and that would be decisive, I think. So I believe that the Court of Appeals definition is the correct one for a number of reasons. It recognizes the distinct wording in the last sentence of 2155, where it specifically says separation of property settlement agreement, not all such agreements. It's consistent with the logic of the abrogation rule. It is consistent with the just expectations of the parties who should expect to be bound by their contracts. It does not discourage reconciliation, where the trial court's interpretation, if you have a marital agreement, a postnuptial agreement like this, it would actually discourage reconciliation if you separated. It's consistent with how the term is used by family law practitioners, the ordinary usage of the term. It's the natural and intuitive interpretation we submit. And it places the contractual rights of married spouses on equal footing to intended spouses, as the first sentence is intending to do. This is an exception to the general policy of the first sentence, and so it would only apply to those specific agreements. How do we get a definition of separation of property settlement agreement? I believe that the Court of Appeals states it well, and it's supported by the case law that led to the amendment of the statute to insert that last sentence. So for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm, unless there are any other questions from the court.
You yes, probably ma'am. Answered this in your dialogue with Justice Kelsey. If the facts are that these parties were separated and they write this agreement to reconcile, what type of agreement is it?
I would submit that's a postnuptial agreement because it's premised on the reconciliation. So it's not premised on the dissolution of the marriage. It's premised on the continuation of the marriage, albeit after a separation. But these are the terms on which we're getting back together, as opposed to these are the terms on which we're going to end it. So if, in that circumstance, I would submit that it would not abrogate. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May I remove my mask?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Carolyn Costell, along with Mr. Bradley, on behalf of Lisa Wills. I want to first address just, I think this is a case of plain language across the board. We have a statute and we have an agreement. This agreement unequivocally establishes and settles property issues upon separation, upon divorce, and other miscellaneous contingencies, but most importantly, upon separation and divorce. It acknowledges that this agreement is settling all properties. It deals with marital property, separate property. It says what will happen upon separation. It says what will happen upon divorce. It says what may happen also upon death. And that the fact that the agreement acknowledges this and says the word property and says that it's selling property means it's a property settlement agreement. Dr. Wills has asked in the context of the divorce that it be incorporated into the divorce order and address and settle all the property in accordance with this agreement. So it is saying that it settles all property, it's having full of waivers settling property, and that's being asked by Dr. Wills in the divorce that it settle property.
Does your analysis of the case accept the concept that there can be a marital agreement that is neither a separation or a property settlement agreement?
I think conceivably there can be marital agreements that don't settle property issues. I mean, there are agreements between parties to do things that aren't quite as comprehensive. I mean, certainly you see contexts where you might see people agreeing to do something in wills or to have will contracts that go to both families. Might be property, might not, but I think you can have agreements between spouses that address property but don't necessarily comprehensively settle property. But this agreement comprehensively settles property. I mean, it describes itself as being a property settlement agreement. It does all of that. And so I think to say that it's not a property settlement agreement because the parties didn't get a divorce right afterwards or something like that doesn't make sense. You have to go to the language of the document. It's a contract, and it's the language.
One thing that doesn't make sense to me is the reconciliation cases were all cases involving the third category of contracts, not prenups, not postnups, not in a state of separation, but postnups in a state of separation where they're settling an ongoing imminent separation or then existing separation. So the statute is written to change the default as to what you presume about reconciliation. Why is that logically, it's certainly not relevant obviously to prenups, why is it relevant to postnups that are not in that third category of imminent separation existing or risk?
I think what the legislature is trying to do is if you're married, you have a different position, and that they're trying to protect people who are married who might be more subject to influence or emotion from being unduly influenced. So I think the idea here is if you sign an agreement that is going to do something with your separation or your divorce, and there are subsequent reconciliations, and in this case, there was a huge blow up just 90 days later. They were getting divorced, and then they subsequently reconciled. There were other ones that were pretty dramatic, too, but just 90 days after this one. But that if you reconcile, at that point, you assume the marriage is going forward. If, however, in any context, if the idea is that you want to create a durable agreement for all time, put in the clause. The statute gives a complete fail-safe. You put in a clause, you say this survives reconciliations, this survives a happy marriage, this agreement is planned to exist for all time. The statute gives it to you. Just put in the clause, and then you don't have any issues.
Counsel,
I think I've
counsel,
gone over.
You have, but answer this question if you would. I appreciated that how you tried to glean the intent of the legislature, and you gleaned it perhaps rather a little bit expansively. When you look at the legislative summary from Senate Bill 226 in 1998, it says very simply, this reinstates the law in effect prior to the decision in Smith v. Smith. How can we get anything more than a reversal or legislative overruling of Smith v. Smith out of that final sentence?
Well, I think that Smith v. Smith was a case in which they decided that that an agreement wouldn't be abrogated because of the modification,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so I think what they're trying to say is, no, this is the rule. The rule is that if you have a separation or property settlement agreement and you reconcile afterwards, it's gone unless you're very clear in that agreement that, I mean, it's sort of the plain language of the statute. The statute says you make it clear if you want it to survive a reconciliation, and you put it in the document, and then it survives. If not, if there is a property settlement agreement or a separation agreement, it's abrogated upon the reconciliation.
Yeah. I mean, I respect that answer, but I think the legislature say we don't like Smith v. Smith, and we want to wipe it out. I mean, I don't, you know, period, the end. So, but anyway,
well, they did. They did. They did try to go to the idea that had been the common law before, which was the idea that if married people enter into an agreement and they then reconcile and come back, the idea is that you're resuming the marriage in its entirety, and it's back to the beginning and back to love and happiness, unless you want to specify that you still want your whatever agreement you signed.
I would simply note it was a 12-word statute, but you are an effective advocate to get to expand upon it to that extent. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel. Please call the next case.